Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Aha, feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Dunker Nation, let's ride YouTube. Hi, I forgot last week, that's on me. Appreciate y'all remembering. Nikias, the action is heating up in the NBA, in the WNBA. Bring your analysis. leave that dog alone. It's time to hoop it up.
It is indeed time to hoop it up. We have the podcast title, so thank you for that. I was going to try to figure out a way to work that in. You know what? Bring your analysis. That does the trick. Also happy to be here, excited to be here. Back home for like 20 hours and then back to Vegas tomorrow, or I guess today, by the time the YouTubers see it on Tuesday. So going to have some fun, going to talk some hoop, going to preview some series, get some W takeaways, get on out of here. But first, on the news side, on the NBA front, the all-rookie teams were announced about 30 minutes ago as we record early on the Monday afternoon. Your first team, Victor Wembanyama, Chet Holmgren, Brandon Miller, Brandon Podziemski, and Jaime Jaquez Jr. rounds out your first team. On the second team, Derek Lively, Amen Thompson, Keontae George, Cason Wallace, and Gigi Jackson from the Memphis Grizzlies. Gigi is a fun inclusion. One heck of a year for him. What made this part fun, 43 total points for Gigi Jackson to nab the last slot on the second team, edged out Trayce Jackson-Davis of the Golden State Warriors by 1 point. That's pretty neat. Did you have any general thoughts on the rookie teams? Anything you disagree with, or how are you feeling about the teams?
Well, number one, he got 5 first team votes as well. So that was also the determining factor.
Yeah, that was.
Salute to Gigi Jackson. He's the only name I didn't have in. Mm-hmm. So no real surprise, but you know, it wasn't because it's not deserved. I wasn't sure it would be recognized. Mm-hmm. So he gave a lot of good effort from Memphis, a good find in a season that was a little tough. So salute to him. I was a little surprised at Derek Lively being on the second team, mm-hmm. considering how important he's been for Dallas. And I know they got Daniel Gafford and made a switch starting wise, but he played so well. They went ahead and made sure they had some version of that all game long. Like, I feel like that has value.
Yeah.
But you know that they love this for Jaquez and Pods. That just kind of is what it is at that point. I was a little surprised at how low Scoot Henderson ended up being.
Really?
I didn't think it'd be that low.
Yeah, people were not.
Yeah, people they'd scooted on off that train.
I got you. Like, on the GG front, just wanted to quickly echo your sentiments there. Like, really fun offensive season. Also, they moved him around defensively. Like, they really tested, hey, you guard Shea tonight. You guard some of these bigger wings. They really tested out the versatility. I'm excited to see what he looks like with a healthier roster with the Grizzlies next season. So exciting for him. I'm with you on Lively. Like, I think on a per possession basis, like, I feel like he was absolutely a top 5 rookie this year. I would imagine, one, like, wings and guards are generally going to have the more eye-popping stats than your bigs. And two, like, Lively did have a stretch where he just missed a bunch of games. And I imagine, like, cumulative value probably crept in for some of the voters. We don't have official ballots. We just talk about it. So that would be my guess as to why he stood to the second team. That's why I don't have as much smoke for it. But I think that is fair. But again, just in the games that he played, like, I don't feel like there were 5 more rookies more impactful. And you're seeing it throughout this postseason run, how important he's been to Dallas on both ends of the floor. So salute to the rookies. A really fun rookie class, honestly. Like, another guy like Blau, I didn't think he was going to end up making the team, but we talked about him in our rookie reports early in the year. Really showcased some high flashes defensively. The drives are fun. Like, there are going to be a lot of talented sophomores in the NBA next season. So quick salute to those guys. Any closing thoughts before we move?
Who voted for Micić?
Yeah.
Salute to Micić, but I was just intrigued.
I was going to leave that one alone. You know what? Well, while we're doing down ballot stuff, I did have one thing I wanted to say.
What you got?
It's going to be very funny coming from me and for long-term dunkers, but like 4 combined votes for Tumani Kamara and Duaw Brees feels low to me. Like, I thought they had good rookie seasons up in Portland. I really enjoyed their defense. I really enjoyed the defense from Tumani in particular. Duaw some things to work on, but fun screener, pick and pop threat, etc. I thought even if they didn't make, either of them didn't make the second team, I figured they would have gotten more love than a combined 4 points or 4 votes. So I will just sprinkle that in there. But again, fun class. Excited to watch them all next year. There we go. And now we can move into some previews. As you will be seeing this or listening to this on Tuesday, feels smart to start with the Pacers Celtics as that series kicks off on Tuesday night. We start there in the East. The Celtics winning the regular season series 3-2, 5 games considering the in-season tournament games. The fun things, though, 4 of those 5 matchups were played before the Pacers traded for Pascal Siakam. And in the one matchup that Pascal was there for, January the 30th, no Al Horford for the Celtics, no TJ McConnell. And I believe Buddy Hield was still there. So some things to glean from the matchups, but not a ton to draw from considering the rosters look a lot differently from there. I think starting with this one, it's a similar thought that I had with the Knicks-Pacers series, where I just kind of had the culture shock question. Is Boston ready to adjust to a much faster team than what they've had to face? Miami wasn't healthy, but they like to grind you out anyway. You get Cleveland, who can play with more tempo, but ultimately they're more of a half-court style. They lean on their defense. Now it's Indiana, who until Tyrese Halliburton got hurt and they had a little bit of a slide and they were trying to, you know, implement Pascal Siakam and things like that. The Pacers had the highest offensive rating in NBA history up until the slide. And after the slide, they finished 2nd in offensive rating. So it's not like they were that bad altogether. So I am curious to see like how Boston adjusts to that portion. Obviously, they have a bunch of talent, but it is such a different style of game that they're going to have to prepare for. I think as often as Boston switches, like they're going to have to be tight on those because Indiana goes. They got to be quick to match up. They're going to have to be quick to take away space because otherwise Indiana will get downhill. They will move the ball. They will cut. They will drive and kick. And this could be a series in which Boston's defense is in rotation a little bit more than they have been throughout this postseason run. So like I kind of start there and I have some other things I want to dig into, but that's probably thought number one for me. What's your biggest question or biggest thing you're looking for heading into the series?
Well, I mean, we can kind of stick there. I mean, the number one thing is it's going to be a different series for both of these teams. Mm-hmm. And the adjustment's going to have to be there for both of them. You mentioned it, Indiana, as we know, team's going to push the ball, made basket, missed basket, it don't matter. They are going to go. The ball movement and the player movement in the half court to force you to sustain your defense. Pascal, Tyrese, Miles Turner, all bring a certain level of talent that you have to deal with, but the Pacers are a collective. And you mix in TJ McConnell, Aaron Nesmith, Obi Toppin, Andrew Nimhard. They can come at you in waves, mm-hmm. Which can make it a little tough to pin down one exact thing, especially with how much they move the ball. I think for me, how does Boston adjust to the tempo is a great question in this series. And I think it's one of those things where you mentioned it. It's getting back in transition. It's having to match up. It's being comfortable with multiple guys defending different people because cross matches are going to happen. Boston's going to have to work to sustain their defense. Breakdowns, there's not the same as against Miami and against Cleveland. And we saw that those were two teams that were able to generate shots. Now, could they sustain it for a whole series? No. But they both won game twos because of their ability to break Boston's defense down, drive and kick, find the openings, find the gaps. Indiana just kind of naturally does that. And they're going to keep coming at you. So Boston's going to have to work to keep the ball in front. They're going to have to nail the rotations. I think one of the keys with the tempo portion is it's not just sets. You know, it's not just push. It's not just pick and roll. It's the drives. Mm-hmm. And so is Boston going to be ready to contain dribble penetration and bog Indiana down that way? When you look at it, Indiana 56.6 drives per game in the regular season. I think 2nd in the league. Down to 51.4 in the playoffs, 3rd in the league. Against the Boston Celtics, the Indiana Pacers, 58.2 drives per game.
That's a lot of drives.
So they're going to have to go ahead and figure out how to keep the ball in front. They have the defensive personnel to do it, mm-hmm. but they're going to have to make sure they lock that in. It's also going to be an adjustment for the Indiana Pacers. And Boston has a lineup full of talent. And the key for Indiana is going to be, can they sustain their defense against this Boston group? The last two series, they worked on defense. As the series wore on, they were able to find different things, take things away. I think their effort off ball has been very good as far as being physical and being active and working to deny. They've had highs and lows where they've also given up a lot of points, you know, and we're talking about a lot of points to the Knicks,
yeah,
who weren't expected to score that many points. And you can't bring that defense to this Boston team because, you know, against those other two teams, Milwaukee and New York, you had help points, you know, where you felt comfortable helping off people. And you could develop some in this series, but it's not going to be the same. And if Boston's able to hit the right buttons, now Indiana's in a scenario where they're in rotation, they're scrambling, they're trying to figure out how to pin Boston down, and that's where it gets interesting.
I got you. Oh, were you about to say something else?
Oh, well, I was just going to say, I was going to flip it real quick, unless you had something on that.
Oh, I'll just say very quickly on the defense front, like I'm, like this is the beauty of Boston building out their roster that way, just circling back to your transition point. Like they've built a roster out of, I don't care who I pick up because I feel comfortable. Like we've seen throughout the regular season, Jason Tatum, you just defend this big in the half court. Jrue Holiday, you can slide up and down a positional spectrum if necessary. And I think if they are keyed in on their transition defense, like it shouldn't be difficult for them in particular to match up with Indiana. So like I think that's just going to be a fun matchup there. And then just a general note to the overall pace, like it does kind of spawn the question for me, how fast does Boston want to play? Because like we've had tempo questions about Boston and how they get into things offensively. Indiana, one, they just naturally play fast offensively. Defensively, they also just bring a whole bunch of full court pressure. And so it's a way to bog things down. But if you do set the screen in the half in the backcourt, you get downhill, now you got space. It does kind of provide Boston a launching pad into their offense if they want to use it that way. So it's going to be a fun kind of seesaw there in terms of the tempo.
And look at us looking like Karl-Anthony Towns and Anthony Edwards at that press conference, because that was exactly where I was about to pivot to. I flip it and ask, can Boston find their tempo? And I use the word find because that balance you mentioned, that's going to be key for Boston in this series. Mm-hmm. Is Indiana going to set the tone tempo-wise? And is Boston going to get caught getting up and down the court and taking quick shots? And does Indiana use some of that full court pressure? Not to bother Boston, like they tried to, you know, just kind of wear down Jalen Brunson, but more, hey, let's get Boston to play a little slower. Mm-hmm. Let's get them to start their sets deeper in the clock. Let's give our defense a chance to load up. Does Boston now get caught in a game where they're starting their sets late? And we talk about the weight of the lineup, the pressure they can put on the Indiana Pacers defense. If it's just one action and Indiana can handle it and they're loaded up, and now Boston has to go to ISO, or they have to go to a post-up, they have to try and figure out how to get one up, mm-hmm. then Indiana doesn't have to feel the full pressure of that lineup. And they can now get a stop. Now they run, score on the other end, do it again. That's where Boston, I feel like, has to work. They need ball movement. They need player movement. They need to mix in attacking matchups. And they have to be ready to mix in drive and kick, force the Pacers to be in rotation, and generate quality shots. That's the thing I'm looking to see. What type of shots can Boston generate? Mm-hmm. We know they'll take them. We know they can get to them. But what is going to be their mindset offensively as far as we need to do X, Y, and Z to open things up? Because in both of those series against Miami and Cleveland, they were able to find the right mix to beat those teams. In this series, with an offense that can go, you really need to make sure that you have everything in order, off ball, mm-hmm. on ball, and you can't really bog down. They can't get in their own way.
Yeah. And like to that point, Boston has things to poke at. Like one, they just have their talent. So this can just become Jason Tatum, you get a side attack. Jaylen Brown, you get a side, you attack. Though I guess if Jaylen Brown's matched up with Pascal Siakam again, like we saw in that January 30th matchup, it may not be as simple as Jaylen Brown ISO, just because Pascal's a really good defender. But they do have the talent to kind of spread things out. As we've seen in the Cleveland series in particular, Boston went after Tyler Hero in the first round. Like they can just tap the Derek White come set screens button or Jrue Holiday come set screens button. No Buddy Hield for Indiana, but Andrew Nembhard, good defender, but you know, smaller than a Jason Tatum if he wants to mismatch hunt. Tyrese Haliburton, naturally, I think is going to be put in a lot of action. And so they have things that they can poke at. I guess what I do worry, not even worry, one thing I'm curious about is how the pick and pops look in this series for Boston. Kristaps Porzingis is not going to be available for, I think, at least the first two games of the series, or at least very early on, he's not going to be there early on. That's going to be Al Horford in that spot. We know Al Horford can pop out on pick and roll and knock down shots. We know he can float to the second side and then go from there. He's not the same level of threat as Kristaps. And even during, I'll reference the January 30th matchup again, since that was kind of the healthiest, you know, matchup between the two with these versions of the roster. Like Indiana did mix in pill switching. They did mix in, hey, we'll let Kristaps get the pop. We'll send the third guy over. Let's see what they do with it. I think they may be more empowered against Al Horford, just kind of let him shoot and kind of funnel shots that way. I am curious to see how Boston balances that. And for Al Horford in particular, not a matter of skill, but are you willing to take six threes in game one? Are you willing to take seven threes in game one? Are you willing to be aggressive and then also mix in the handoffs to get Indiana in rotation? Because they're able to keep Indiana in rotation. Or if Indiana feels like we got to do something else, we have to switch this. We can't afford to defend this the way that we have been early on. Does that open up even more things for Boston to poke at? And if they can just kind of flow between, we can mismatch Hunt, we can go off ball screens, we can go into post-ups, we can go pick and pop, we just go pure drive. If they feel like they can do anything, does that help aid Boston's pace? They don't have to think as much because no matter what we do, we feel like this is a pressure point. We can get downhill. We can make y'all scramble.
I hear it. A little ironic considering Al Horford said bleep it in game five against Cleveland and put up 13 threes.
Sure did.
So it would assume that we would need that version of Al Horford. I wonder if, you know, the Porzingis factor is important. But for me, I kind of think about him just not being in it as of right now. I wonder if they're able to balance some of that out with attacking matchups. And I think they're going to look to put Tyrese Halliburton in action. And, you know, that's no disrespect. It's just kind of something that's shown up. Boston's not afraid to matchup hunt. We saw that in the Miami series. We saw that in the Cleveland series. They wanted to put Garland and Mitchell in action all the time. See what opened up. In the Knicks series, New York really tried to put Tyrese Halliburton in action against Jalen Brunson. And for most of the series, Indiana did not want to give that switch up. He did get better as the series went on and the shows were strong. I thought he did his job and Indiana was ready to help behind it. But this, again, is a different team. And Boston has Drew Holiday and Derek White, who become even tougher to deal with when they are the ones who are screening. They have no problem operating in pick and roll and becoming a roller. And so if that ends up being a scenario where it ends up being two on the ball and you see Drew and Derek White on the short roll and who those kickouts are going to, I wonder if that's something that Boston can mix in effectively, just kind of keep pressure on Indiana in a different way. And I wonder if Boston, because they can get creative with how they try and get you to switch, do they get to some of the off-ball actions where you can get Halliburton involved and see if Indiana wants to switch that? Or if they're going to be clean on that coverage, you know, just elbow action. Derek White hits the elbow, comes off a flare. Are you ready to defend that? Is that a way we can kind of poke at you there? And now we can play and attack the matchup we want. So I'm intrigued to see how much switching Indiana wants to mix in and how they work to try and contain against Boston's attack.
Got you. Like, it's funny. Like, one thing I had in my notes is literally, is Tyrese Halliburton ready for this challenge? Not from a skill standpoint, not from a competitive standpoint. We know how good and how competitive he is. But just because Boston is such a different beast from the version of Milwaukee that they saw and the New York Knicks, and towards the end of that series, the version of the Knicks that they saw as they just started running out of bodies. You already mentioned the different ways that Boston can and likely will attempt to put Tyrese in action. Is he going to be ready to deal with that? With some of the post-ups, if they do try to steal your turn, try to reverse engineer some of these switches. Let's use Tatum as a screener. Let's use Jaylen Brown as a screener. Is Indiana going to live with that and say, you know what? If this guy takes a tough two, he's got to live with that. Or as we saw sprinkled in through that January 30th matchup, is that going to be an immediate double or immediate dig down? And is all Boston able to now generate open shots out of that because you're sending extra attention? So I'm curious about that front. On the offensive end, I have the Bucks series in my head. As Milwaukee towards the end of that series, again, didn't have enough. Indiana outplayed them. They won. But they did go to more switching towards the end of that series. And just looking at the offensive efficiency, when Tyrese pick and rolls got switched or just when Indiana dealt with switches in particular, efficiency went down. Guess who has pristine personnel to switch a whole bunch of stuff? It is the Boston Celtics. And so I am curious to see just what volume Boston goes with the switching, because they can just decide to switch everything if they want to. But do you sprinkle that in? We switch one through four, whether Tyrese is on or off the ball. And then when Al Horford's involved, we'll start with the drop and see what he does. If it's that, I'm really intrigued by some of the rotations we'll see from Boston, like something that popped for me in that last matchup. It would be a deep drop for Al Horford, but they will still have a second layer of help. It's Tyrese Halliburton coming off. And now Jason Tatum's defending someone on the wing in the corner. Now he's just stepping up to take the Tyrese drive. And it's Derek White or Jrue Holiday, whoever had Tyrese, they're veering off to take on Tatum's man. And they sprinkled that in a few times. And I guess that also just ties into the general Boston defensive versatility point. Do we see the return of the one man Jrue zone like we saw in some of the earlier matchups? Like, I'm really intrigued by what Boston will try to do to kind of slow down this Indiana offense. They have the personnel, but like, how much of the scheme versatility back do they actually tap into?
One of the questions I had written down was, which buttons do you want to hit if you're Boston, and when do you want to hit them? Mm-hmm. Because you mentioned the element of the personnel. I think that will have a big impact on this series, because if you arrive at a point where we feel comfortable with a lot of people guarding Pascal and Tyrese, so now those actions becomes a switch. We feel comfortable with a lot of people guarding Miles Turner. Those actions become a switch. We put, you know, a Tatum or a Jrue on Turner just to go ahead and make that a switch. And now what are you going to do? What are you going to flow into? Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff intrigues me. But is Boston going to start with a base? Are they going to come out right up the gate saying, hey, we're going to switch. We're going to take these things away. We're going to bog things down. Because as powerful as Indiana's offense has been, when defenses have been able to find that activity to kind of bog them down, to get them in the mud, we've seen them have success. Mm-hmm. And crazy to say, considering the Pacers, set a field goal percentage record?
Boy, did they.
NBA playoff history. So again, this could flip very quickly, but I'm intrigued. Is it just the off-ball switching? You mentioned 1-4. Is that going to be the key for Boston? You mentioned the drop. How does Boston balance that switching with, oh, we're in drop with the big, Tyrese has space to operate with. Does that open things up? Mm-hmm. Those rotations you mentioned, that's part of the reason why Boston has to nail the rotations, because if you're going to fly around and try and send late help or take off, you know, take away the space that Tyrese has getting downhill, you need to nail the next rotation, because Tyrese is a very good passer, and Indiana has been in these scenarios where we have to make the defense pay. So it's not like they're surprised or not going to be willing to take and make shots. I'm intrigued to see if they can poke at the Miles Turner portion. Like, is the switching going to be the thing that maybe takes him off the board a little bit, because mm-hmm. he's been so key to the Pacers' attack?
Yeah, he's been very important. I will say further Miles Turner commentary for the X Factor portion. But as you kind of dipped into the matchup bag, because I feel like when we do these series previews, I always go into, okay, who's guarding who? How can you cross match? How much fun are these teams going to have? Boston, obviously a prime candidate to just play around with who they want to have on whoever. The Pascal thing is going to be interesting for me, because going back to the January 30th matchup, like, it was Jrue just starting off on Pascal. And Pascal got some deep post opportunities. He missed a couple bunnies. He also got some easy buckets, got some offensive rebounds. I'm just like, you know, I would imagine that based on how they go with Pascal, whether that's Jrue on him, they want to put Tatum on him, et cetera. I'd imagine they want to turn the Tyrese Pascal pick and roll into a switch, or the dribble handoff into a switch, and feel comfortable with that. How much mileage are they going to get out of the post-ups or the ISOs? Like, can Pascal establish himself enough, early enough, to where Boston feels the need to send a second defender? Again, I think the beauty of having the personnel that they do, being able to, you know, let's go back to the regular season, Jrue Holiday, you just have Joel Embiid to start the game. Like, having a guard that you feel comfortable doing that with is, we can stay out of rotation. It's either going to be a tough two, or because Jrue is so good at defending the post, we're poking the ball away, we're going the other way, now we're getting easy ones, now you got more pressure on you. If Pascal is able to ding some of these cross matches, if it's Jaylen Brown getting the assignment early on, if it is Jrue, if it's Jason Tatum, and you get some body blows, get some early foul trouble, does Boston react? And if Boston starts reacting, is that another way, in addition to the shooting, the drives, the overall pace, is that another way for Indiana to put some pressure on Boston's defense? This could be a pretty big Pascal series.
Do you think Pascal looks more comfortable in this series? Or is it just going to have to be cycling through matchups?
I guess the answer is yes. I feel like if Boston trends smaller on him to start, he could feel more comfortable. Because I think in the Knicks series, you start with OG. And like, Pascal was able to find a level of comfort, but like, that's still a very strong, bigger wing body. And then you get to the Josh Hart portion of the program. It's like, oh, well, I'm bigger than you. Later on in the series, you're also not healthy. I can just kind of get to my spots now. With Boston, again, like, I think Jrue is a better defender than Josh Hart. And like Drew versus healthy OG is at least a discussion. I think a lot of people take Drew, and I think that's fair. But like there is just a general size element. And just looking at the actual shot attempts, regardless of what the result was, Pascal was just able to get to where he wanted to get to and get to layup attempts versus some of the, you know, face up mid range jab and J jumpers that he can make, but they don't put the same pressure. They don't put the same strain on defenses. So I think Pascal could feel a little bit more free. Like he's coming from Toronto. He's used to seeing a bunch of switches to say the least, all due respect to the Toronto pals, but like he's used to seeing a bunch of switches. And if you're just feeding him a size mismatch to start, I could see a world where first quarter of game one, Pascal has 9 points on 3 of 5 shooting in the first quarter. And it's like, oh, okay, well now Boston has to do something different.
I'm again intrigued by the put a big on someone strategy from Boston, because who do you put it on? We saw Milwaukee try to shuffle it. The answer was not Pascal.
Yeah. So we saw Brook Lopez on Aaron Nesmith. Like maybe that becomes the point. Do you try it on Andrew Nembhard? Like those probably be your two best options if you're not going to do that on Pascal.
Yeah, I'm intrigued to see who they choose, and then I'm intrigued to see if Pascal can find that blend of, hey, I've got the drives going from the perimeter, I've got the post ups here. We can kind of ding you in different ways depending on what you do. I think he's going to be a big key. On the other end, that made me think, Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, do you think they have the drives going in this series? Because one thing that Boston did in that regular season matchup, oh, Andrew Nembhard's guarding Jaylen Brown, here's a post-up. Mm-hmm. Hey, Jason Tatum, you have Aaron Nesmith, go ahead and catch at the elbow one time. Is that going to be something that makes it really tough for Indiana if they are locked in with the drives, with getting to their spots, with attacking in different ways?
I think it can be, and I think that puts the Jays under a very familiar microscope. You have a talent advantage. You have a general size advantage, depending on how Indiana decides to match up. We will give you these mid-post touches. Are these just going to be jumpers? You're good enough to make them, but are these just going to be jumpers? Or, if Tatum's catching the ball at the free throw line, is this one dribble, gather, extend the arm, draw foul? If it's more of that bag for Jason Tatum, if it's more of the quick attacks for Jaylen Brown getting all the way downhill, which as I think back to that last matchup, talk about setting the tone from Jaylen Brown in that first quarter. I want to say midway through the second quarter, he has 6 free throw attempts already. It's like, yeah, that's kind of what he can do to you. But if they have that kind of mindset in combination with those touches of where they're getting them from, yeah, that could absolutely be a problem for Indiana. But like they're going to have to be intentional about that.
Nailed it. Can I be briefly unserious?
Sure.
Peyton Pritchard versus TJ McConnell. That's personal, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Glad we cleared that up.
Yeah. I'm sure there's a Larry Bird quote for this, which speaking of which, hey, we got is this not just the Bird Bowl? Lowest of keys. Also the Aaron Nesmith revenge series. Like we got some fun stuff in here. While we're here, let's shift to the X Factor. Steve, who are your X Factors in this series?
For the Boston Celtics, it is Derek White and it is Drew Holiday. And one thing I'll point to, in the regular season, Derek White, 16 a night against the Pacers, 39% from three. Drew Holiday against the Pacers, 14.6 rebounds, 52.9% from the field, 47.8% from three. I think their ability, obviously defense, they're going to need them on that end of the floor. But offensively, they are where things can swing. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the questions I had is, hey, what happens if Derek White and Drew Holiday are help points? And if you look at their two playoff losses for the Boston Celtics, Drew shot a combined 6 for 19 from the field, 1 for 6 from three. Derek White shot a combined 8 for 19 from the field, 3 for 12 from three. It can't be a portion where now Indiana feels comfortable funneling those shots to those two in different scenarios. Mm-hmm. So they need to be aggressive. And I think the difference with it is they can be used in so many different ways. To where they can handle the ball, they can self-create, they can mix in post-ups, they can be screeners. So it's hard to necessarily nail them down mm-hmm. to a degree. And now if they're able to impact the game in different ways, it makes it hard to hide defenders. It makes it hard to deal with the weight of Boston's lineup. So I think those two are so key. For Indiana, it's Miles Turner for me. Mm-hmm. Again, I think he's just been so key for Indiana's playoff run, done his job defensively. His ability to hurt teams when he's spaced, when he's rolling, the pick and pop, the decision making, it's all been strong. And they're going to need him if they want to make a push in this series to poke at Boston's defense. Because if he can solve the answers of what Boston could throw, if he can make them pay if bigs are in a drop, I think that helps Indiana overall, especially in the half court. But, Nekias,
what's up?
In the regular season against the Boston Celtics, Miles Turner, 14 points, 7 rebounds, 42.9% from the field, 20.8% from three. It probably can't be that.
Yeah, not if they want a long series, it can't. Tell you what, the shot's going to be very important for Miles Turner, as you mentioned. The drives for Miles Turner are also going to be very important. If Boston feels the need to rotate out to him, we've seen some very fun poster dunks and poster attempts from Miles Turner, but like beyond the actual highlights of it, him being a dual threat just adds another dimension to this Indiana Pacer offense. So going to be very important. Good call on your front, on your part, excuse me. For me, it starts with Aaron Nesmith for Indiana. I was between Nesmith and Miles Turner. And T.J. McConnell, which you already mentioned T.J. McConnell's role in this. His drive's obviously going to be very important. But for Aaron Nesmith, if Boston does play around with, like as I mentioned earlier, Tyrese comes off of pick and roll there and drop. Here's the second defender just taking the drive, and now they're veering off behind that. A lot of that is predicated on, one, having good personnel, smart personnel. But beyond that, it's easier to do that when you have a help point. Aaron Nesmith can't be a help point. We know he can shoot. He can't hesitate to shoot. He has to knock down a high clip of shots on high volume. His drives are going to be important. I think Caitlin Cooper had a stat, which I remember what the exact number was. I think Aaron Nesmith had 18 pull-up twos last season, and he has blown that number out of the water this year. Like his growth attacking closeouts has been very vital. You've seen how important his drives have been throughout the postseason as well. He's got to nail that if they do decide to run him off the line. And defensively, he's going to see a whole lot of Jason Tatum. He's going to have to not get blasted by Jason Tatum. Push out the catches, make life tough on him. Don't find himself in foul trouble like he did a couple times against Jalen Brunson. He's going to be important on both ends of the floor for the Indiana Pacers. For the Celtics, you went Miles Turner with Indy. I go Al Horford with Boston. He's going to have to be tidy in the drop. If he has to creep up, he's going to have to be able to get out of there without getting letting the big get behind him, whether that's Miles Turner or if they keep rolling with Isaiah Jackson as your backup. Those lob opportunities could be there. Indiana, not exclusive to them, but they are a team that doesn't mind lifting from the corner to remove that help. So if Al finds himself backpedaling, he's going to have to be ready to challenge some of those lob attempts from Miles or Isaiah if they're rolling. And then offensively, we already touched on a little bit earlier. If Indiana decides we're leaving those pops until you prove that we can't do that anymore, it's going to be up to Al Horford to prove that they can't do that anymore. Take the shots when they're open, knock them down at a high clip, keep the chains moving. If you do get the straight post up, if Indiana tries to mess around with any kind of cross matching and putting a smaller body on him, a couple of post up touches, a couple of buckets, a couple of fouls drawn, maybe it'll take that off the table for Indiana. So could be a big Al Horford series as Boston waits for Kristaps Porzingis to return. Steve, who do you have in the series?
Who do I have in the series?
Yes.
I have the Boston Celtics in 6 games.
Okay.
I think the Pacers have a path to victory. I think they're probably going to steal one early because there is going to be an adjustment that needs to be made. I think Boston has the defensive personnel to figure it out. And offensively, they can put more pressure on Indiana's defense. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be a fun series. I got Boston in 6.
Okay. I also have Boston. I was toggling between 5 and 6. Like, I don't know if this one goes 7. Because I do think there is still just a talent gap between the two teams. You just said 6, so I will say Boston in 5, just to try to be a little bit different from you. But I do think Boston, they have the advantages on both ends of the floor. They have a level of scheme versatility and matchup versatility that I don't think Indiana can quite tap into. There is very clearly a pathway for Indiana to pull this off. When you have that kind of offense and that kind of star power and you play with that kind of pace, and even if you throw in some of the Boston malaise as you get into some of the second halves of these games, like there's absolutely a pathway for Indiana to not only make this competitive, but like extend this to 7, maybe steal it. But I do think Boston is the better team. I have them coming out of the East. With any closing comments, thoughts, something that you're looking forward?
No, I think we nailed it.
Okay. All righty then. We will then move out West. The Minnesota Timberwolves facing off against the Dallas Mavericks. In the Western Conference Finals, the Wolves won the regular season matchup 3-1. However, All four of these matchups were played before February, and thus all four matchups happened before the PJ Washington and Daniel Gafford trades for Dallas. So again, there are things that you can take from, but these are different teams, particularly on the Dallas front. And even if you look at these matchups, I think Luka missed two of those. Kyrie missed three of those. So, like, you didn't even get a healthy dose of the stars for Dallas in this one. If you want to go back to last year, you can. Like, I nerded out with some of the Luka being defended by Jaden McDaniels possessions going back to last year. But not a lot to take from these specific matchups. I think for me, to kick off the conversation, I am naturally intrigued to see what Dallas tries to do against Anthony Edwards. I'm also curious to see what the Timberwolves do against Kyrie. Like, I'm really curious with those two in particular. Luka's going to see a bunch of everything. And we're obviously going to talk about Luka. But with Ant, like, I just have the Denver series fresh in my mind for very obvious reasons, in which they kind of mixed in, all right, Jokic, you're at the level. We'll try to sprinkle in some drops super early in the series. Now we're just going to throw out some doubles teams to you. And with Dallas, not that they can't play more aggressively in pick and roll. Like, they just kind of haven't wanted to. Like, they've kind of leaned more on the switching, especially if you're using the OKC series as a reference point. So I just wonder, like, does Dallas feel the need to ramp up the pressure against Ant? And if so, how can Minnesota play out of that? Because we've seen the good and the bad of what that looks like when the role players are there. Jaden McDaniels knocking down shots, etc. It's cool when they aren't, or if there's any kind of hesitancy, the half-court offense for Minnesota could get a little shaky. And then with Kyrie, hasn't been the greatest scoring postseason for him. I do think he's played well throughout the playoffs. We've talked about the defense and we've talked about the playmaking. He's seen quite a bit of drop. If you want to go back to the Clipper series, they did also just mix in two on the ball against him. So there's a level of scheme versatility you can toss in against Kyrie. I'm just curious to see what Minnesota starts with Kyrie. I think there's an argument to start with drop with him, especially if it's Anthony Edwards getting that matchup early on. If it's Mike Conley getting it, they may still trust Mike to navigate just because he's still a good screen navigator and good defender at this stage. I just wonder if they try to take that Clipper blueprint. Like, let's put two on the ball. Let's just make sure you don't even get going as a scorer if we can help it. And put even more pressure on Luka to kind of carry the load offensively, or some of those role players to knock down shots from the perimeter. So I kind of start with Ant and Kyrie. And I know we're going to end up getting to a bigger Luka discussion later.
Well, here's the thing. I'm glad you framed it that way. Because the first thing in my mind was, both these teams can do it. How are they going to try and do it? And who blinks first? Mm-hmm. This is going to be a fun series, man. I'm really excited for it.
Yeah, you know, real defense is back.
You got real hoop. You got Anthony Edwards. You got Kat. You got Luka. You got Kyrie. But larger than that, and I pull it back real quick, we have two teams who found their identity and use that to make this run. And all year long, Minnesota showcased the type of defense that they can play. They wanted that Denver series. They believe in what they do. And you could feel that during this playoff run. And Dallas, on the other end, made that trade in the middle of the season that helped shape their team to be able to make this kind of run. Like, it's not copy and paste the formula of the last Western Conference Finals run, but it's close. Mm-hmm. You know, they've got Luka, they got Kyrie, we have size, we have length, we feel confident in our ability to make defenses pay. We feel confident in our ability to work through a playoff series and adjust. They figured the Clippers out, they figured OKC out. Now you have to figure out Minnesota. And my brain has been all over the place trying to figure out what these teams are going to try to do each other on defense and what do they land on? What do they believe is going to get them the series win? You know, which team is going to find it first? Which team is going to establish their identity? I think when it comes to Anthony, we'll start with Kyrie, right?
Okay.
Because in my mind, this does feel like a Kyrie Irving series. And they're going to need his scoring. They're going to need his playmaking. And they are going to need him to put pressure on Minnesota to do something different with him. Can he mix in those pull-ups from three, from two? Can he get the paint touches to open up the late lob? Can he poke at matchups? If Kyrie is now able to play at that type of level and Minnesota thinks, hey, we have to do something different. We can't let him ISO, we got to send a double. In pick and roll, we got to bring Rudy higher. Hey, we can't switch Cat, or we can't be in a drop Cat. We have to do something different there. That's where it gets fun. And like lingering in the back of my mind, and I'll say it before I forget, I'm very interested to see, and I think JJ said it on the Old Man and Three Things, who decides to put two on the ball? Mm-hmm. And what does that open up? Because you mentioned Luka's going to see a little bit of everything. You mentioned, hey, maybe we just take Kyrie away. that could just open things up for Dallas. Mm-hmm. And I think the one thing that you got to be careful about, the story is always, hey, can Dallas make you pay for your help, for your rotations? Does Minnesota want to start with that gamble based on how Dallas has played all this OKC series? Mm-hmm. And is Kyrie the tipping point? You mentioned Luka. You mentioned he's going to see a little bit of everything. It's another series where he has a very good perimeter defender that's going to work to navigate screens and contest everything with a big lurking in the paint. Mm-hmm. I guess for me, with Luka, I would assume Minnesota starts out in a drop. Can Luka knock down the shots to make them pay? Will he hunt them? Mm-hmm. But I'm also intrigued, okay, do we mix in more post-ups this series against Jaden McDaniels and see if we can get some fouls? Do we try and attack Karl-Anthony Towns and see if we can get some fouls or see if we can poke at that matchup? How do they move Luka around the board a little bit? Just kind of poke at Minnesota. Because I think in earnest, the first team that gets the other to not defend with conviction is going to end up with the advantage.
That can get fun. Like, I think very quickly on the Luka front, the Wolves blitz Luka on shade over 30% of his pick and rolls. That was the fifth highest mark of any Luka opponent this year. 0.92 points per possession for Luka pick and rolls during the regular season series. But again, like, he missed a couple of those games. So small sample size is an even smaller sample size. So it is worth it. Like, they were willing to ramp it up against him. I think a lot of that was just, hey, let's see if we get Cat in action. But they are willing to do so. So I think there's going to be a healthy dose of that. In addition to, as you mentioned, Jaden McDaniels, I think he's just licking his chops at this matchup, just based on the type of competitor he is. Like, we saw some of the comments or heard some of the comments throughout the Nugget series with him taking the Jamal Murray challenge. I do not think he's going to be afraid of Luka. That does not mean that Luka won't drop 40 on his head at some point. But at the very least, he is not going to be afraid. Jaden, one of the best perimeter defenders on the planet. So, like, I am just, as a basketball fan, excited to watch those two duke it out. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I'm intrigued and I'm interested to see, because if they go ahead and put two on the ball against Luka early, that just opens up the lob. Do you want to do that? Mm-hmm. Like, my mind goes to Minnesota in that Phoenix series where it's like, hey, you know what? This is what you get, bud. This is it. Mm-hmm. Everything else, not there. And so my mind is balancing between how many matchups does Luka try and cycle through and what does Minnesota try and do when he does. Continue.
I got you. I was going to say, like, I do wonder or slash worry about Minnesota getting to the point where if they continue to blitz Luka and they also try to ramp it up against Kyrie, like, even with their defensive personnel, like, they can do it, but I wouldn't feel great about them feeling the need to do that. Like, that very much needs to be an intentional, nah, we are establishing our defense. We are letting you know we are here. We are flying around. We're scrambling. You have to, but you don't have the openings that you think you do. Coincidentally, all of these openings are to the right corner. Guess who's in the right corner? Derrick Jones Jr. So it's open, but it ain't the opening that you want. Like, if they decide to try to dictate terms that way, I feel a little bit differently. If Luka comes out and makes his first three shots, and then you're also just trying to ramp it up against Kyrie, like, that's where it's like, hey, that's a lot. That's a lot of strain on your defense. Y'all already have to work hard. And if Dallas is scoring efficiently, this is a now elite Dallas defense that is now just getting the opportunity to be set against you. And the half-court offense for Minnesota has been much better than I anticipated throughout this playoff run. Like, it wasn't until, like, Denver won the two games, games three and four on the road. But through the first six games of the postseason, Minnesota just had the best offense among playoff teams. I didn't anticipate that part. But, like, if you're just looking at Dallas offense on balance versus Minnesota offense on balance, and you kind of zoom out for the year, like, you probably just feel better about Luka plus Kyrie plus lob threats, cutters, et cetera, versus the Minnesota group. So, like, they do have to establish that portion. Like, they don't want to get into a situation where Dallas just feels super comfortable, and now it's even more difficult for you to create open looks, especially if Dallas just continues to lean into the switching bag. Like, okay, fine. Have fun. You're not getting any cracks up top. We're switching. We're pinching and help where we can. Again, a way to funnel shots. If you can break through this wall, congratulations. Do it again and again and again and again.
You want to go back to Anthony Edwards real quick?
Sure.
I'm wondering, is it going to be a blend of schemes from Dallas against Anthony Edwards? Mm-hmm. Because the one thing, Anthony Edwards has done a great job of making plays, making reads. He's made all the shots all playoffs long. Dallas does have the benefit of coming off a series where they really had to work to contain one-on-one, to contain dribble penetration, to rotate. I think an underrated part of what Dallas brings to this series is, hey, we have size and length. We can make some of those windows tough. But we're also, they've timed their rotation so well in the paint. Is this a series where we feel like, okay, let's throw different looks at Anthony Edwards? You know, do we switch some of these? Do we bring the drop back with our bigs and trust we can contain? Do we work to maybe mix in two on the ball, depending on who it is? Mm-hmm. But then it's a balance, because if you put two on the ball against Anthony Edwards, one, he's making the plays. Two, you now open up Rudy as a role threat. And now Minnesota can kind of get some more creation that they may not have had before. Mm-hmm. Or you open up Cat on the pop. I guess the other factor is, how much do they want to put Luka and Kyrie in action? Mm-hmm. And how does Dallas want to handle that portion of it? So we've seen Dallas be a lot more comfortable with switching in these playoffs, and it's paid off and benefited. But can they find that layer? Can they get to a point where they feel good about the switches against Minnesota? Because I think in my mind, if this series gets to a point where Rudy ends up being a switch, Kat ends up being a switch, Dallas feels comfortable with Kyrie switching on to Anthony Edwards and guarding, Luka can hold up. Where's the button you hit if you're Minnesota?
Yeah.
And so that's where I'm intrigued to see, okay, what are they trying to do? Is it a blend of coverages that they try and throw at Anthony Edwards? Are they going to try and stick with one thing until he makes them pay? Mm-hmm. You know, is it going to be one-on-one? We just, you know, we're going to show help, take away the drive, protect the paint. A la kind of how they treated Shea, and just try and take everyone else away, just make it tough on them. Mm-hmm. The counters are there on both sides.
I got you. Like, I think that's going to be a fun battle within the battle. Like, this is where I quickly salute the defense of Kyrie again and the defense of Luka throughout this postseason run. Like, I think we've all acknowledged throughout this postseason, Luka's not 100%. And so the fact that he is competing on that end and ultimately, like, holding up pretty darn well defensively so far, I think it's a testament to him and the work he's put in, his level of engagement. It's a hat tip to Jason Kidd to getting him to engage that way. So I did want to give the flowers very quickly. This does feel like, for Luka in particular, this feels like a different challenge than the OKC series, just because of some of the, I guess, like, where some of these pick and rolls may come from if they decide to go mismatch hunting. Because, like, Minnesota, more so in, like, transition, but they have showcased the willingness to, hey, let's just set the screen 40 feet up and see what y'all going to do. With OKC, like, they do what they do to kind of clear space from the wings and stuff, but those are generally lowered angled pick and rolls. And you may feed Shea the matchup, and he's trying to get to the mid-range anyway. But, like, there isn't, like, a wide range of ground that you have to cover on this isolation, in addition to Dallas being able to kind of show help behind Luka when they need to. In this series, like, Ant may call for the switch 35 feet from the basket. And because, like I personally feel like, you know, Shea, I think Shea's a better offensive player right now than Ant. Ant might just pass him by the end of this postseason run. But just in terms of pure burst off the bounce, Anthony Edwards is a different level from Shea Gildas-Alexander by how quickly he can get downhill. And so if you're adding more space for Luka to have to cover, and just, you know, with that exposure from Ant, it's a lot of strain on that help to be in on time. Because if not, you know, Luka may get dinged in a way that Shea wasn't able to, just because of, again, difference in explosion, but also just play style. Shea's very comfortable. I'll take a couple of dribbles. I may have only gotten to 17 feet, but, like, this is where I want to be. Versus Ant, I want to get all the way downhill. I'm sprinkling these pull-ups just to make y'all feel bad, and I've gotten better at that shot throughout the year. But ultimately, I want to get all the way down here, and you can't move laterally as fast as I can get downhill. So that's going to be an interesting battle. If Ant is able to kind of take some of the Luka switches off, in particular, off the table, and Dallas feels like, we got to do something else, even if it's just switch and double, that feels like a win for Minnesota. At the very least, it can be.
No, I'm with you. Again, lingering in the back of my mind, this whole conversation is, if you can get two on the ball and make someone blink, I think you got the advantage in the series. Mm-hmm. And, like, the more we talk about it, the more I'm just thinking in my head, boy, the mix of things they can throw at these guys to try and keep them out of rhythm is wild. I want to see what it does.
Can I ask you a question really quickly?
You got me, dog.
I hope I don't throw you too off course, because I feel like you got something else. Whose bench do you feel more comfortable with heading into the series?
Whose bench do I feel more comfortable with heading into the series?
Yes.
Ooh, I mean, I think it's Minnesota by default. No? Because Naz Reid has shown that he can play and make you pay in different ways. The drives have been there. The scoring's been there. So I think I would probably lean Minnesota right off rip. They have not had a Naz series quite yet.
Yeah. Like,
and I will say the three-point shooting probably needs to go up for Minnesota. And I guess by shooting, I should make three-point making needs to go up for Minnesota. I mean, because you look during the playoffs, McDaniel shooting 34%. Naz Reid shooting 31% from three. Naz shooting 32.3% from three. I don't know if that can be the program in this series. Because, again, we talk about who can put two on the ball. We talk about different things they can throw at them. If this becomes a scenario where Dallas is like, actually, we feel comfortable sticking with what we've done against the Clippers and against OKC, and, hey, we're cutting the paint off. You can kick it. We're fine with those shots. We'll get out the cat. We'll fly around a little bit. But ultimately, it's going to land in the hands of someone we want. That shifts the series to me. Mm-hmm. And so I probably trust them a little bit more. When you look at Dallas, I think the tricky part is, can Lively be a roller? And Tim Hardaway Jr., can he make shots? Mm-hmm. If they get a different version of Tim Hardaway Jr., then I think it's a little bit different. But I trust Minnesota's folks that there's more of a do-your-job type beat to it, as opposed to Dallas, where high ceiling, what's the floor?
Got you. Like, that's why I was curious, because I think in a vacuum, like, you know how I feel about Nickeil Alexander-Walker and Naz Reid, and even Kyle Anderson, though this has not been the best postseason for him. We'll just be kind and leave it there. But, like, just in a vacuum, I feel better about Minnesota's. But then when you think about, you mentioned the three-point shooting from those guys, and we know Kyle doesn't really take those. And Naz Reid, we saw the highs of when he could just kind of take over a quarter with the scoring. Early on, we saw when they were blowing Denver out, like the kind of defense that he can play. It has felt like, at least coming off of that series, it felt very up and down for Naz Reid on both ends. And they are just going to need a level of consistency from him. I don't think it's impossible for him to do that, but they are going to need that from him. With Dallas, one, Derek Lively has just been a metronome for them. I'm going to come in. I'm going to challenge shots at the rim. I'm going to help on the glass. I'm going to throw down these lobs. If you try to hack me, I'm going to also make my free throws, which has been a very fun development. And so he's just been that. And then I think about just the larger, Kyrie's going to be on the floor. One of Kyrie or Luka going to be on the floor at all times. All we kind of need is for y'all to provide a pocket for us. Hey, Jaden Hardy, just throw a couple lobs and don't be lost on defense. Cool. Tim Hardaway Jr., just knock down a three or two. Cool. And that's where I'm just kind of like, it does Dallas have more of a, I don't say just a pure bench edge, but like, is the gap closer than people may be giving credit for? Just because I think the threshold for what they need from the bench is a little bit lower than Minnesota's. And so it kind of feels boom or bust for both of them based on what we've seen throughout the first couple of rounds, at least offensively.
No, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. And I think you bring up a good point as far as how Dallas, you know, they're also in the do your job category. I guess for me, it's Minnesota could probably survive bad performances from their bench. Dallas can't as much. Does that make sense? Like a bad stretch from Dante Exum, you feel it. A rough stretch from Josh Green, you feel it. Whereas with Minnesota, they might be able to survive some of those because the defense is the defense. Is where my head is kind of spinning with that.
See, yeah, that's where I normally would be. But then I think about how good Dallas' defense has been this year. And just like, well, I don't have the firm answer here, to be clear. Like, it's just something that I'm just thinking about. Like, hey, this might be, if you told me this was, basically, if this was March 1st and you told me this was going to be the Western Conference Finals, like, I would come in with Minnesota has a bench edge. And now I would just pencil that in. And like, how these first two rounds have gone, I was like, they might still have it. But it's certainly closer than I anticipated it being. And that's with Tim Hardaway Jr. being as up and down as he's been. And so that's why I'm just like, I'm genuinely curious about how that's going to shake out. While I'm in the... Oh, go ahead.
What was I say? If Dallas has a bench player that lands, that gets really sticky if I'm Minnesota. Mm-hmm. But go ahead.
I was just going to say, while we're briefly in the Nekias bag, how important is the offensive glass going to be in this series?
Nekias, what are your thoughts about the offensive glass in this series? Why did you ask me that? Look, man, this is a rough time for me. This rebound stat is destroying me. It's beyond me. So go ahead and cook, man. Hey, I'm processing 98 different things in a basketball game. And then y'all be like, well, it's just the rebounding edge. And I can't say you're wrong. But at the same time, no.
Well, no, I do not believe that the rebounding thing is just going to solely decide the series. I will say we have seen where Derek Lively, Daniel Gafford, PJ Washington getting some timely ones, et cetera. We have seen where Dallas could just kind of ball folks on the offensive glass. They've been able to do so throughout the postseason. And with Minnesota, we know what kind of impact Rudy Gobert can have, what Cat can have. Nas Reed, electric offensive rebound midway through the fourth quarter, last night as we record on a Monday. And Minnesota is also just generally a big team. So that just feels like a swing factor for me. I didn't have like 12 fancy stats or anything like that, but it's just like that feels like something that if it's super close, that could absolutely swing some things. So I am just generally just keeping an eye on the rebounding. I'll also ask you a general question. Who is the pace more important for in this series?
Pace? I would probably say Minnesota. I think Dallas is comfortable either way. Mm-hmm. I think Dallas is comfortable playing slow. I don't necessarily knock them on that because they have people who can generate shots, and I don't want them to be too slow, but I think Minnesota does need to have an element of starting their sets at a certain time, playing with a little bit more movement. They're going to have to find it at times and be able to force Dallas to rotate, so I'd probably lean there. I think there's a who could score a transition point that's in the back of my brain as far as who's going to make these stops count. And we've seen both teams kind of have those moments where we get stops, our defense gets us back in it, we're able to score real quick. Dallas had some wild sequences against OKC. We've seen what Minnesota can do when they're able to get easy ones. So I probably value, okay, who's scoring off the stops more than just general pace? Is there a side you're leaning on with the pace?
Like in the back of my head, it's just Dallas just playing generally faster than they ever have in the Luka era. I think top 10 in pace this year. I'm trying to think if it's seventh or eighth throughout the regular season, but I know they were top 10 this year. And a lot of that is just Dallas gets stopped defensive or Luka quick hit ahead versus him like pushing the pace. But like in light of the Luka health, I do wonder if Dallas getting some easy ones to where he doesn't have to see a set defense, potentially two defenders and all that good stuff. Like, are you able to just take some pressure off of him? I do probably still lean Minnesota. So I'm with you just because I think the early attacks for Anthony Edwards is going to be super important. Obviously he has the talent and the burst to get all the way downhill in the half court. But if you can, minimize those chances and kind of just flip the scale to more early offense transition, get them downhill easier so you didn't have to see an entire wall of defense. I think that'd be more helpful and just get Minnesota in a position to where they can kind of attack tilted defenses. That kind of blends into how important Cat's going to be as a driver in this series. Like, I'm sure he's going to see plenty of PJ Washington in particular. But if they're getting into the stuff early, like I think it's still Minnesota. But just a thoughts, last question that I had.
You know what thought I have?
What's up?
How does Dallas want to defend Karl Anthony Towns? I think Cat is a huge key. And I think we've seen over the course of this playoff run for the Minnesota Timberwolves, when Karl-Anthony Towns is able to produce offensively, it just adds a layer for them. Mm-hmm. I think it's just key, with him improving at the four, with his ability to drive space and cut, when he can ding you at the five, and especially in this series in my mind, okay, we've talked about how much Dallas may want to switch, but let's say there's a world where they don't switch everything with Cat, right? Mm-hmm. If Dallas's bigs are in a drop, does Cat have more openings when he's at the five? Mm-hmm. Is he able to get to some of the pick and pop and knock down some threes? Now he drives a closeout. And now you kind of have that layer of, well, Cat's dinging us when we put a small person on him. He's dinging us against a wing, when he got big. And now that's a whole wave. One thing from the regular season, he sure liked that Derrick Jones Jr. matchup at times. Mm-hmm. And it's different for Cat when he's able to establish his position. when he's able to get it at the elbow or closer to the basket on those post-ups. And when he takes his time and initiates contact and goes to work, that's tough. Now, the reason why I say that's important, does Dallas want a double? Does that open up a layer where Dallas has the double team? Again, two on the ball. Brain's just been working on it. And those rotations are different than, hey, we're containing dribble penetration, we're helping on these drives. Those are a little bit more automatic. And does that open something up for Minnesota? Or do the doubles keep Cat in the box like we saw at times in the Denver series? Kind of a back and forth, kind of a yin and yang. How much Luka does he see? Is he able to draw fouls? Are they willing to switch smaller defenders on him to start? And what does he do when he's spaced? So I think the one thing about Cat that's been underrated this year, he's gotten a lot better cutting when he's spaced. Mm-hmm. So we'll see if that has an impact in the series, if he's able to hit that. But also, he feels different than Chet, per se, where OKC didn't necessarily have the balance between drive and kick and drive and score. And I think Cat has that aggression where, you know, as long as he's not hitting the turbo button, he's able to kind of drive, make the right reads, attack those closeouts and make you pay that way. And so if he's able to kind of get that blend together, that just puts another thing that Dallas has to worry about on the table. And so I'm very intrigued by that. But this is also a series where I guess I'm intrigued to see what he's going to do defensively, how they want to employ him, and can he stay out of foul trouble? Because, you know, is he going to be at the level? Is it going to be a switch? Just kind of keep an eye on that.
I got you. There was a one of those hard drive Euro step type possessions in that game 7 that immediately brought you to mind. I was like, oh, Steve would absolutely hate what we just saw from Cat. Also, just very quickly, differences between him and Chet. It helps that he could probably take 3 3-pointers in the time it takes Chet to take one. So that could be a difference. All due respect to Chet. But no, that kind of aids into the off-ball value there. You quick trigger, and also you throw in the cutting and stuff from there. So, yeah, so just sprinkling that one in there. I do think, naturally, Cat's going to be very important in this one. Like, I would imagine they try to test out the switching first with Cat. Let's try to keep Dallas as much in a box as possible, and then we'll ramp it up if necessary. I could be wrong, obviously, but like it feels like they may, based on what Cat's been able to do during this postseason run, they may try to dial it back with him a little bit. Let's see what we can get. And if they ding us, then fine. We can kind of go back to the base with Cat and we have him at the level and kind of play out of that. That would be my guess anyway. I had another question for you, but I guess I'll just save it for the X Factor portion of the program. Who is your X Factor heading into this one?
To be determined on one portion, because my mind is thinking about, can Derrick Jones Jr. and P.J. Washington be used as screeners? I will go Mike Conley once again. Mike Conley against the Dallas Mavericks this season. 51% from the field, 52% from three. They're going to need Mike. If Dallas is going to be rotating, they need Mike to make shots. They need Mike to drive closeouts. They're going to need Mike Conley to play at a high level. For the Dallas Mavericks, who's your X factor, actually? Because I don't want to take yours.
Well, for me, like, my primary X factors are just in the same box. I have Jaden McDaniels for Minnesota. I have Derrick Jones Jr. for Dallas. Hey, you're guarding the other team's best player. You're going to have to do that without getting in foul trouble. Hey, they're probably going to leave you open on the other end of the floor. You have to hit corner threes and drive closeouts when appropriate. So it feels very copy and paste. Like, obviously, they're not the exact same type of players, but they do feel like they're going to be in very similar roles, and thus their impact, positive or negative, will have a pretty big sway on the series. So that's kind of where I went.
And then I will go P.J. Washington.
Okay.
They need aggressive P.J. Washington. Like, I don't know if he has to be, hey, I'm making 5+ threes for 3 straight games, like he did in the OKC series, but they're going to need him to have the aggression to take those shots, to drive when he needs to be a factor, to make Minnesota think, okay, maybe we can't do that. Or maybe, you know, he's someone who can make us pay all the time. So I'd probably say PJ.
Okay. Oh, can I toss you a very quick Mike Conley question then before we get into our predictions and move?
What's up?
Who would you start Mike Conley on defensively?
Who would I start Mike Conley on defensively?
Yeah. Do you start him on Kyrie, or do you, like, you know, I think it's fair to say Jaden's going to get Luka. Like, do you want Conley on Kyrie to start, or do you want Ant to get that assignment? Now you have Mike Conley on, like, Derrick Jones Jr. Kind of cycles into, like, you're open up as a roller point. But where would you start with Mike?
I have a feeling Ant will want that Kyrie matchup, considering what he had to say about the Jamal Murray deal. So I guess that would put him on to. Well, see, I don't know if you want to start him on PJ, because Dallas might just be like, hey, we're going to post PJ up, which isn't the end of the world, but I don't know if you want to give that opening.
Yeah.
I guess it's who do you want Kat to guard as well. They kind of go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. I'll say Derrick Jones Jr. to start.
Okay. I want to get your thoughts. You know what I had in my notes slash a thought that I had?
What you got?
What if Ant wants Luka?
I'm afraid I've got some bad news.
You just get Ant the first couple of possessions on Luka. You got Jaden on Kyrie. And then you still had to have Mike Conley on Derrick Jones Jr., I guess. Like, it's just a straight thought that I have. So, you know what? I didn't expect him to start on Jamal Murray, and that's what it was very opening of game one. And we saw more of that as the series went on. So it wouldn't surprise me. Ant's just like, I'm the alpha. I want to do this.
Well, I guess the other part is, what are they going to be willing to switch Mike onto Luka and or Kyrie? Or is Mike going to be in a show and recover? Because now if he's guarding one of the wings, does that once again open them up as rollers? You see how my brain is just...
This is why this series is going to be very fun. This is going to be a whole lot of fun. All right, Steve, who do you have in this one?
Well, I got to go first, man. I don't want to go first, man.
Well, fine. I will go first. I have the Dallas Mavericks in six in this series.
Wow. Dallas in six, huh?
I have Dallas in six. I think I have fewer questions about how they want to guard and what they want to open up offensively than Minnesota. That's kind of my base reasoning for that one. Similar to the last series, I will keep an eye on the Luka health. Like, that was the primary reason why I went OKC over Dallas in the last round. But, like, Luka seems – he's obviously not 100%, but he does seem fine. And again, like, I kind of trust Dallas to generate some openings in the half court a little bit more than Minnesota. So I will lean Dallas in six right now.
This is a hard series to project. Like, it's sure a fun is. Series to talk about. It's a hard series to project because we're going to watch game one and game two, and it's going to be like, oh, the game is the story. That's what's going to happen. Well, there's that. Both teams have a pathway to victory. I have loved what Dallas has done. I think they've nailed the formula. I think Luka and Kyrie are probably going to have the mindset and have played well together and are going to find ways to attack Minnesota and put pressure on them. My mind can't shake away from how bad Minnesota wants this and the mission that they've been on. And I could be wrong. I would not be surprised if Dallas won, but I'm going to go Minnesota in seven.
Okay. That would not shock me at all if Minnesota is able to win this series. I'm just ready to dig into that one. Ready to dig into both of these conference finals matchups, but I'm really ready to dig into this one. Like, that's going to be some gnarly defense, some tough shot making. I'm sure there will be tease, as we do have teams with some stars that generally are not pleased with the way that they are reffed. So I'm sure we will get some funny memes out of that one throughout the series as well, but very excited for this one. Moving on to close things out. Normally we would go into the, you know, what is the losing team going from here with New York and with Denver as they both lost. We'll save that for the next pod, get into some W talk before we get out of here. Very quickly on the news front, talk a little bit about the charter flight program. I think Kathy Engelbert said something along the lines of we want to have it by June. Looks like things are going to roll out May 21st, which would be, you know, by the time you listen to this or watch this today. So glad that all 12 teams will get the charter to and fro. Those players need travel. They need the accommodation, so glad they're getting it. Also on the news front, the WNBA to investigate the Aces' $1.2 million sponsorship deal with the city of Vegas. Another year, another investigation in terms of benefits. So we will keep an eye on that as we get more information on that front. If you missed that one, the city of Vegas announced that they want to sponsor every player on the Aces, $100,000 per player. W going to look into that and make sure it's on the up and up. So as we get more updates, we will talk more about that. Unless you have quick comments, Steve.
Oh, no. I think it's lovely. Shout out to Vegas always. The W very quickly raising their hand and say, hey, didn't we just talk about this?
Are you for real?
Hey. Calendar invite sent. See you Tuesday.
Yeah, this, we will catch y'all on Zoom. That's going to be very fun. But before, I guess, aside from the news, I wanted to get to some takeaways. We did have a few games over the weekend. Most teams have played, I think, 3 games at this point. At the very least, they've all played 2 to this point. So very quickly, can we talk Caitlin Clark or Leah Boston? Just for a tad.
Let's do it, man.
We're recording on a Monday afternoon, so we do not have the second Fever Sun game at our disposal. So that may be a big Fever win. That may be another big Sun win. We don't know yet. I just would like to stress patience with not only Caitlin Clark, as she has not played 5 games in her W career yet, but also Aaliyah Boston, who is dealing with a more specific scouting report. As we saw that update throughout the year last season, won Rookie of the Year, made an All-Star team, et cetera. We're seeing that update. It's also just trying to implement Caitlin Clark in the style of play that she has, her pick and roll prowess, where she's setting those picks for Caitlin, what the defenses are doing against Caitlin, and what openings are available from there. And this is all while trying to work in more touches for Nalissa Smith. This is while trying to reintegrate Kelsey Mitchell into the starting lineup. As she missed the preseason games due to an ankle injury, she was coming off the bench for the first 2 games, starting in the 3rd. So there are just a lot of moving parts with the Indiana Fever offense as a whole. And so I would just like to stress patience for Fever fans, new Caitlin fans that are coming in and now watching the Fever a little bit more. Like, let's chill generally. But I am kind of curious with the pick and roll reps, because I think what we've talked about on the last pod, actually, with Caitlin seeing 2 on the ball, and how she generally deals with that, and kind of the angles that she takes on her retreat and some of the passing windows from there. I think it is a mix of Caitlin having to get better against that kind of aggressive coverage with this level of defenders on the W side. In addition to Aaliyah is just now in a new context for her. Like, date back to the South Carolina days. Like, South Carolina was not they weren't a heavy pick and roll team. And even when they ran it, like, they did not have a Caitlin that consistently drew 2 to the ball. And they especially didn't have a Caitlin that drew 2 to the ball, like 30, 35 feet from the basket. And so I ended up posting the clips on Twitter yesterday with some examples of, here's Caitlin getting 2 on the ball. Pay attention to which way Aaliyah is turning on some of these. Pay attention to some of the paths that she's taking on some of these roles. Not as a way to, like, slander Aaliyah or anything like that, but it's just like, no, this is literally a learning curve for her. She has not had to play like this in this kind of space. And, you know, friend of the program, Taka, he sent me some clips as well. It's like, yeah, well, there have been some positive flashes, and I agree. And you can see where she plays more in the pocket. She's turned the correct way. She gets the early pass. She can get downhill and score, get to a mid-range jumper, or she can make the next pass. So it's not a matter of skill. I do think, again, circling back, it's just a matter of time and reps. It doesn't help that the Fever have started against 2 top 3 defenses in their first 4 games. So in one way, that kind of accelerates the curve. But on the other hand, it's going to look like this, to where Caitlin has had, 21 turnovers in her first 3 games? And we don't know how the 4th game's going yet, because it hasn't happened yet as we record. I just want to stress some patience. Keep an eye on, again, the role paths and the way that Aaliyah opens up on some of these, how quickly she gets there, and Caitlin dealing with pressure in general and teams trying to shade her to her right hand and how she's dealing with that. I think they're going to be fine. Just very quickly on the number front, through the first 3 games, 36 pick and rolls between Caitlin and Aaliyah, 0.76 points per possession on those. And even on the dribble handoffs, only 9 of those, but 0.25 points per possession on those trips. Obviously not good, but I think there's some obvious upside there as they get more time together and as the season goes on. So this is what it is, but let's just relax a little bit.
No, this should be part of the journey. Like, I know the excitement and buzz, but you're signing up for the journey of the Fever improving as a whole and Caitlin Clark improving as a whole. You mentioned who they faced. I mean, you got to think, it's being bothered by Dejanay Carrington and Bynai Jelani Hamilton while also having to deal with Alyssa Thomas, Brianna Stewart, and Jonquel Jones.
Yeah.
It's not the most fun. And I think it's one of those things where the Fever are trying to figure out what's the best route for them. I thought, you know, it's the fun part of the matchup is you get to see them play these teams again. So I thought Caitlin Clark came out with a mindset. Hey, I'm going to drive. We're going to get the ball out quicker. I'm going to try and throw it ahead. I'm going to attack and pick and roll. I'm going to make these reads and plays. As the Fever grow, they're going to have an understanding of when to hit certain things and when to attack certain matchups. Even if it's just, hey, guard, let's see if we can get Caitlin Clark downhill. Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get a split, play with Nelissa, get a kick. So I think that gets interesting. And I think the timing of when do we get it to Aaliyah Boston in the post? When do we go to this pick and roll? The passing is hit. I still think the hard hedges and shows are still causing that real quick turnaround. Wait, what do we have? But there'll be time for the fever. Mm-hmm. As they get that focus, as they execute, things will be good. Speaking of which, the New York Liberty defense, huh?
Tell you what, man. Tell you what. Those bigs and wings are doing the thing.
Just wanted to mention that real quick.
It's pretty neat.
What else did you want to bounce around WR?
I'll go quick as we're on a bit of a limit here. But as I was in Vegas for the Aces Sparks game, just quick shout outs for a couple of rookies. One, Kate Martin made her regular season debut for the Aces. Did not play in game one, played in the second game. 3 points, 5 boards, 3 assists, and a block in 26 minutes. And was a +8 in those minutes. And I think the Aces were a +9 in 12 minutes, excuse me, when they went to Kelsey Plum, Jackie Young, Alicia Clark, Kate Martin, and Asia Wilson. Downsized in part because of what Cam Brink was doing on the other end of the floor. We'll get to her shortly. We talked about this in the watch party. We talked separately about the Aces draft class. We still haven't seen De'Asia Fair yet. But it was one of those things where I'm just like, I get why you make these picks. Like, I get why you want the explosive scoring ability of De'Asia Fair. Like, I get the gap filling of Kate Martin and even the Elizabeth Kitley pick, like, just from a talent perspective, obviously recovering from injury right now. Like, I kind of got it. But based on how Becky Hammon generally treats rookies and based on the roster situation in general, like I think I said it on my timeline, like I would be surprised if they made the roster. Not because they aren't good, but just how the Aces generally function. And so for them to make the roster, one, and for Kate to have this early impact, it was impressive to me. Like, I was impressed watching the fourth quarter of that preseason game. And, like, even before the preseason game happened, you know, just in Aces media things, the way that every player basically raved about what Kate Martin was doing in camp, I was like, I'm going to have to flip my expectations pretty soon here. Like, I didn't expect her to make it. I got it, but I just didn't expect that. And she's making an early impression. She may factor in way earlier than I thought. And for her to get in game two, we did not see Kirsten Bell in game two after seeing her in game one. And Kate Martin immediately making the right passes, making quick decisions, getting downhill and keeping the chains moving, competing on defense. Again, basically a blindside block against Lee Yeru, who is 6'7". And the way that the crowd exploded when Kate Martin hit that transition three, the team seems to love her. The coaching staff seems to love her. The fans surely love her. It was an impressive debut. And if the Aces can get that kind of production out of Kate, that certainly helps with the lineup versatility. And on the other side of the coin, like, I do kind of wonder, you know, Kirsten Bell got her last year guaranteed, or the option exercise, excuse me. So she's going to be there this year. But I'm just kind of looking at the rotation now. Like, hey, man, this is all kind of adding up for Kate Martin right now. Now, again, it's one game. She may just be awful. I'm going to be back in Vegas for the Mercury game on Tuesday. So she may just have a bad game on Tuesday, and then we're back to square one. But one heck of a debut there on Kate Martin.
Really good fit for the Aces with that versatility. Just glue. Just I can do a little bit of everything. I can defend multiple positions. I'm good on ball. I'm good off ball offensively. I'm going to cut. I'm going to move it. I'm going to drive and kick. It's not necessarily Alicia Clark, but hey, we have someone who can also do some of that. Mm-hmm. So that helps our lineup versatility. It's a plus. And I think for the Aces, just have more things that they feel comfortable with, more lineup combinations they can throw out there. That's a big plus for them. I think Kate Martin fits right in. You know, if she's going to play that kind of defense and be able to be trustworthy on both ends of the floor, that's something you can tap all year long.
There you go. And also in the game, career high 11 assists for Jackie Young. Asia, once again, incredible on both ends of the floor.
Real quick. I know I'm on a time limit here, mm-hmm. but if Jackie Young is going to do this, buddy, look, you give her a heartbeat of space and it's just right up on top of the drives. On top of just what the Aces do in general, hey man, hey, just keep that in mind. Also, Asia Wilson flying off screens for threes, huh?
Yeah, just man.
Continues to get better. Hey, that De'Erica Hamby matchup was fun. But
it sure, hey, De'Erica Hamby was drives and drives and drives and drives and more drives. Just continuation of what we saw in the preseason from her. Rekia Jackson, as I'm talking about rookies, think 13 off the bench. for the Sparks, hit a career threes that made Becky Hammon very upset as they have no consecutive possessions. But hey, that fun rookie class in LA. Glad you shout out Jackie. She's been incredible. Asia's been good once again. Also, keep an eye on the one-legged fadeaways from Asia Wilson. Asked her about that post game. Like, hey, man, this seems different. So keep an eye on that. On the LA side, though, Cam Brink against the Aces, 3 points, 8 rebounds, 1 steal and 5 blocks in 25 minutes. My brother in hoop, she is already having a ridiculous impact on the defensive end of the floor. Three things from Second Spectrum on the Cam Brink game. Defended 8 pick and rolls as a screener defender. The Aces scored a grand total of 0 points on those possessions. The Aces went 2 of 11 with Brink as the primary shot contester in that game. 0.9 points per possession on drives for the Aces. Not a great number, but 0.9 with Brink off the floor. Down to 0.8 points per possession when Brink was on the floor. And there were multiple possessions, particularly in the first quarter. Well, Kelsey Plum's faced in the corner. They go through their office. They swing to Kelsey. Kelsey just slam beat someone off the dribble. She's getting downhill. Here's Cameron Brink rotating. Nope, I am dribbling to the other side. We are not dealing with that. The Aces were able to get a couple of cuts from Megan Gustafson. So they were able to counter some of the help from Cam Brink. But the fact that she is already dictating terms defensively, and I mentioned the smaller unit that the Aces went with Kate Martin in, with Alicia Clark, Jackie, Kelsey, Asia. And I asked Becky about it, like, hey, what'd you like about this one? She was like, what I like is that Cam wasn't in the paint like that. it's just like, hey, it reminded me of when we used to try to do that against Rudy Gobert when Becky was in San Antonio. Like, we just had to find a way to get her away from the rim. And it's like, you know, if a rookie in game two has the defending champ, they're like, we need to move you out of the way. That seems to be a pretty positive sign. Now, we do have to limit the fouls. That is a thing that has to happen. So we will continue to monitor that. But hey, between the drives and the passing and stuff in the first game and in general, the defense through the first two games, Cam Brink is off to a fantastic start.
I agree. I think the timing on the weak side defense was fantastic. You mentioned all the points. I would also add real quick, just if I can annoy you.
Okay.
What's up? Are you ready for a Cam Brink depoy talk?
I'll tell you what, if she defends like this, I won't be as annoyed about it as I would be with others. Again, it's, you know, 2-game sample for her and some other teams have played 3. We're very early into the season, so we'll see how it develops. If she can't stay on the floor, like that's just gonna hurt the case. But okay, the rim protection is there and like the rim deterrence is already popping through 2 games. So again, like even, you know, I mentioned the 5 blocks, but like there were a couple of jump balls called with Asia trying to attack Cam Brink. I was like, yo, this is special stuff. This is special stuff. Also, appreciate the attitude from Cam Brink. There was one foul call on her in the first quarter that I didn't even agree with. I was like, hey, I don't think that was a foul. And Kia Stokes went to the line. She missed the first free throw. Cam very loudly with a ball don't lie. I was like, you know what? Well, that's what I'm talking about. That's the kind of juice we need the players to come with. That's fine.
Can I speed run a few thoughts?
Yes, absolutely.
Hey, watch out for the Minnesota Lynx.
Yes.
I really enjoyed the Alana Smith addition. I did not think, and of course it's a small sample, that would be 19 a night. I'm shooting 71% from three. Just did not have that on my bingo card. But watching Nafisa Collier, who continues to improve, and having to defend those two, where, hey, one can roll, one can pop, we can have one space in the corner, and the havoc that's kind of causing on defense is the belief the Lynx are playing with early on both ends of the floor has stood out. I want to salute the Connecticut Sun, by the way. Dejanay Carrington having a year,
yes,
on both ends of the floor. So I would salute that as well. I'm very intrigued to see what Angel Reese looks like against non-Dallas Wings. But that was a good second effort, good second night. The Phoenix Mercury experience, huh?
Hey, they going small zone, they going ball. Small. Hey, listen, it is 5 out, small ball. Hey, here's some zone. Here's some Natasha Cloud on Tina Charles. We dare you. Listen, hey, they Tibbetts having some fun with this group. I gotta hand it to them. It's early, but
Diana Taurasi is a screener.
Yeah,
just consistently just DT screening and, oh yeah, it's Kalia Copper turning the corner again and again and again over and over and over. It's, we got a car driving kick to Sophie Cunningham for a three.
Did not have that on the bingo card, now did we?
With celebrations.
Yeah. Also, hey, let's channel the DT physicality for good. Let's use it as a screener. That's a good bit. But
bad call, double drag.
Here's some Spain. I'm saying they're doing some fun stuff in Phoenix. Also, Seattle getting the first win. We hope NECA is okay. I think she is questionable for tonight's game with ankle injury. She missed the last one. As you mentioned, the Wings, I guess what's left of the Wings at this point, Natasha Howard, broken foot, I believe is the bit, or broken toe. It is a foot injury. We'll frame it that way. So we'll be safe. But she is out for a while Jaylen Brown is already out. I think she comes back next week. Satu Sabli again out until after the Olympic break. So we're looking at August for her. Injury starting to pile up for Dallas, but they're going to keep competing. Keep an eye on their front court. Keep an eye on Arike, who's off to a hot start. Also, quick congratulations to Arike on the engagement. So I wanted to give a salute right there. Any other shout-outs you want to get to very quickly before we get out of here?
I think I speed ran through all of mine.
Okay. Julie Van Loo in Washington. Fun passes.
She's going to pass.
She is going to pass. Hey, That's some fun stuff. Also, you mentioned Connecticut a little bit earlier. I'm just keeping an eye, not necessarily a negative note, but Bree Jones obviously working her way back from injury last year, still in the minutes restriction, I believe. The Sun have had her at the level, and hey, I don't know if that's fair to anybody right now. Let's get Bree Jones back in the drop for a little bit until she gets the wind under her, et cetera. Because those reps, they have been – we'll keep the brow raised. We'll keep the brow raised, but you see the offensive impact for sure, but –
Oh, real quick.
What's up?
Can we talk about Ryan Howard real quick?
I tweeted it the other day. Hey, we might be talking all defense for Ryan very soon. And that's in addition to what she's doing offensively, which if you would like to wax poetic to close us out, you can.
Oh, no. I've been impressed. The shot, if the shot's going to be this on top of the driving ability, I think that's a whole different layer for the dream. So that's something that stood out to me in the back of my mind. Like, hey, this is a little different. And if this is going to be like that, it's tough.
Yeah, the leap may be here. Again, very early. We'll see what it looks like as we pod on Thursday. We have some more W takes for you. But beyond that, thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcast, you can find us. If you're watching us on JJ Reddit's YouTube channel, we are here every Tuesday. That is the day after Monday, the day before Wednesday. So if you haven't subscribed to JJ Reddit's YouTube channel, please do so. Support us. Also, just a lot of great content on the channel throughout the week. So you don't want to miss any of that, especially as the W season continues and as the playoffs continue to be in full swing. So come have some fun with us. You can follow me on Twitter at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter. Having fun discussions in there. Join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties if you would like to watch basketball alongside us. With a group of people that love hoops and are just generally good people, do so. The link is in the podcast description. It's free to create your profile. Come rock with us. Come have some fun. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.
Richie, we did it!